Dr. Rock's radio show on autonomousmedia.net. Live, internet chat radio, every Thursday night at 9. We go to 11.
This is your number one radio station. Tune in and rip the knob off.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on autonomousmedia.net, where we've got a much better functioning broadcaster tonight. There's only a minimal echo in my ear because I failed to follow Nick Nomic's recent instructions. But this week it's bearable and I will not be talking like some kind of robot as I try to keep up with my own voice. That was Bad to the Bone from George Thorogood and the Destroyers, on the basis that, that's just basically how it is, isn't it? Before that we had Redneck Women, a song from a real woman who likes to drink a beer on a four-wheel drive tailgate and cuss and say hell yeah and all the rest of it. And before that, Doctor Who, because things have been moving so fast around the surgery recently that I barely know who I am, and I've been meaning to tell you about it for the last 3 weeks, but darlings, I just haven't had the time. Next week, maybe. Tonight, though, I'm really, really happy to say that Stella Berg's come back to me. Come back to the Dr. Rock radio show to talk about neo-feminism, Satanism, and the family. So we're up for a chirpy chat. Hey, Stella, are you there?
I am. Good evening, Ben.
Good evening, Stella. Thanks very much for joining us again. I really appreciate it.
Well, I must say, I was just thinking as I listened to your music, which I love, by the way, how much of my old favourites have been really ruined by knowledge of their Satanism, and how nice it is to hear people singing who are independent.
Yeah, and we're going to be getting into Satanism and just exactly what it is, because it's not what people might expect. But I think that, and you're right about the tunes, actually. For example, I didn't, for 3 years on the radio show, I didn't play any Led Zeppelin for particularly that reason, which is a bit weird, because I still regard them as the greatest hard rock band that ever walked the planet. And they never recorded a bad, a song that you couldn't listen to. Every single one of their albums went to number one, before it was even released, you know. And despite all of that, I couldn't bring myself to play them, but I do compromise now. I have to, you know.
Yeah. You forgive it in the end, don't you? Some of it, in some ways.
Man, it's endemic. But, it's not a conspiracy. It is the way society works, so who can blame them, you know, in a way?
I wonder if it's true that a lot of them talk about the spirits that inhabit them and how they make the genius. I wonder if it's true, or if the 60s and 70s were just full of really fine musicians.
I think that's a really interesting point, because it seems to me that one of the world management's team's basic techniques is to take kind of innate, natural human drives and just turn them a little bit so they're no longer going where they would have been going. And it may well be that these people are incredibly inspired, but if you get to them young enough, and you offer them enough women and men or money or whatever it is, then you have them. And it's just a little twisting, isn't it?
It is. It's very subtle. You couldn't do it if there was nothing there to start with. It's like the very brightest and the best get turned.
Yeah, that's quite right. That's like I did a few years of kung fu by means of defending myself from being beaten up, which worked quite well, it has to be said. But eventually I decided that it was really too heavy for a man of my frame, and I went for several years of Aikido. And with that one, it's no use unless somebody actually attacks you, because you're going to be using their strength and their weight against them, which I feel is the way it needs to go, really.
Yes, that makes good sense. So much of what we are is what's been elicited from us, isn't it? And I think in a sense, I was thinking one of the things we're talking about is how the machinery elicits different things from people. Because when you're born, I don't think you're a complete blank slate, but you come with certain abilities and capacities and potentials. But then what is elicited is now it's a deliberately engineered program to suppress all that's been natural to mammals and intelligent humans for so long, and only place the emphasis on developing some really rather primitive and crude and destructive.
Yeah, sides. But kind of worse than that, you label the result human nature.
Well, it's not that's for sure.
I think you're quite right there. So, yeah. Where
should we start?
Well, I think given that, I mean, basically we want to talk about, for very good reasons, which will become apparent, we want to talk about neo-feminism and its connection with Satanism and the family, which sounds utterly bizarre, but in fact it's so completely normal that it's quite shocking. But I think before we go there, because, I mean, let alone neo-feminism, feminism itself has got an awful lot of baggage attached to it. So I think that perhaps you're kind of pretty well placed to give us some kind of summary as to what people originally meant when they were talking about feminism.
Well, I'm not sure I can. I can give you my views about it.
That's as good as we can expect, mate. Carry on.
Nobody has a monopoly of truth, sadly. I think we have to go back such a long way, and I'm going to start on a completely different line, actually, but it is about this. I've been thinking a lot about the Enlightenment philosophers, and I want to do some research on this. But Hobbes and Descartes and Locke and Hume all seem to me to have been starting off this agenda at the very beginning.
Really?
Because, well, if you think about Descartes, it was getting rid of God, wasn't it? And
yeah.
if you think about Hume, life was nasty, mean, brutish and short. You know it wasn't. It wasn't. I've been doing more research into this too. People didn't live shorter lives. What they had was we talked about this, didn't we? The mean lifespan was short because so many children died. But actually, if you survived those perils, you were likely to live long and fruitful lives with good food and fresh air and so on and so on. So what the Enlightenment did and the arrival of scientism over traditional living was it started deconstructing all these basic roles that people had. Man's relationship or human's relationship to the planet, to whatever you'd call God, to the social order, all started their destructive path downwards, I think, about then. And then another few generations went by, and then we had Freud, who I'm absolutely certain now was part of the same program, and it was his nephew, Edward Bernays, who started what has now become the Tavistock Institute, which is all about changing the relationships of humans to each other and their environment. So I think I'm beginning to see a pattern that began all that long time ago.
And it's a thing that's really quite difficult, I think, for people to understand, is that what we're dealing with is a kind of committee of aristocracy, what we might call royal blood, for want of better words, and artists and scientists, that the best minds are being bent towards this kind of storytelling.
Yes, it's a deliberate. It part of it is this idea that the victor writes the history books, and in the English or the British were the first people to be ethnically cleansed that I know of. Ripped off from the land started being enclosed, and it started here before anywhere else. And when you get stripped of your land, you also lose your neighbours and your traditions and your environment. And English I'm going to just stick to English for the moment. The English inheritance was a very mystical one. It had all the stone circles and the dolmens and the Stonehenges and the ley lines and a huge amount of indigenous knowledge, which of course was taken from us. So that the roots of it go back a long, 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 long way. Gosh, I'm almost tangled up. There's so many thoughts I have going on here.
It's a very interesting point, isn't it? This business of the fact that we had a deeply mythical tradition and that our indigenous knowledge was taken from us, because the United Kingdom, as it is known, is a repository of something like 70% of the general global geology. There's massive amounts of really extraordinary geology in one small place, and most of our ancient sites, stone circles and the rest, are situated in places of geomagnetic anomaly, which of course arises largely from the geological substructure. So it would imply that the people that were living here had a pretty deep knowledge of things that we're only really just starting to take a trowel to, really.
Yes, we are trying to remember it, put it back together. And I think we can do that because the earth energy is very strong. Meantime, though, what's happened to the people is we've lost our history, we've lost our kinships, we've lost our relationship to the land. And I think that is partly what made it much easier after the Industrial Revolution to start dismembering clans and families. And then that's when you can start. I mean, isn't it extraordinary? You come all the way back to today and you look at the end product, and we are mammals who are not allowed to perform mammary functions in public. Disgusting. It's weird, isn't it?
Glands are a problem, mate. They're not to be celebrated.
No. But how did we get from here to there, or there to here? Well, one of the big steps, yes, was indeed the first wave of feminism, and I was there for it. I was very radically feminist at one point, but it was very apparent to me that there were two strands going on. One was that our femininity was being taken away. You know, when I was at college, it was almost impossible for any intelligent woman to say she wanted children, because that was just so unintelligent. On the other hand, there was this lure being held out that if you were bright, you would have a chance to express it as well as a man. And that was very exciting. So when did we lose that? You know, the ability
didn't it? I mean, this is where the line between what we might call feminism and what is known as neo-feminism needs to be drawn, because one of the main things that's being done, as we know through semantics and words, is that the lines are being blurred. We might assume from the phrase neo-feminism that it had something to do with feminism, which is not necessarily the case, would be my guess. What do you reckon?
Well, I think it's a successor in the sense that in the interim between the first wave of feminism and the second, women have gone back to being womanly or been approaching getting back to being womanly. So another wave of attack has been needed. You know, I believe the first wave of hippie energy was very wholesome. It was rapidly taken over by the CIA. And if anyone is interested in this, there's loads of stuff on it on the internet now about how this really was a very infiltrated movement. But it started off with people like Stephen, who started a farm and brought back intelligent human-style midwifery outside of a hospital. And organic food growing and love and peace. It was all very wholesome, and it was a human, beautiful human natural agenda that was being developed.
Once again, the basic drive was probably correct, and almost as soon as it arose, it was suborned, because as we outlined earlier, and that's if there isn't anything there first, you can't drive it forward.
That's right. Or maybe it was just humans rising and needing to be stopped.
Well, they had a huge problem at that point, wasn't it? Because it's not just the hippies, it's that there was the civil rights movement, there was the anti-war movement, and I was brought up during the Vietnam War. And so civil rights, the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, and the basic uprising of the hippies and the feminists and all sorts of people who actually wanted to, I guess, reassert what it is to be human.
Yes, it was. I think it was a beautiful movement, and I've always felt very strongly that the hippies haven't finished doing their work yet. You know, we're in our 60s and 70s now, but we are the most pestilential, demanding, passionate generation. And I think we still have some jobs to do, like being the silver-haired generation, being called on to come back to the barricades.
Do you want to tell your story about offering to kiss the bailiff?
Oh, yes, that was fun. That was my beloved Yorkley Court farmers who squatted a farm near us that nobody had wanted or lived on for 70 years. And they took it over and they started producing food for the community and became much loved. So, of course, they had to be evicted. So, of course, they were. But the first attempt didn't work. And I was flexing my muscles in the sort of common law area at that time. And I went down there, and they wouldn't let me across the farm gate. There was a bailiff and several security guards. And the security guard, who turned out to be the boss in the end, it was a short, fat, burly chap, and he stood in front of the farm gate and said, "You're not going in." And I said, "Well, I must, because I've got patients in there, and I'm concerned about their well-being with all this going on. So I must go in." And he said, "Well, you can't. You have to go across me, and if you touch me, it's assault." So I gave him a big smile. I'm quite a fat woman, right? I gave him a big smile, and I said, "Well, if I kiss you, is it?" And he went beetroot with shock. He didn't know where to put himself, because it couldn't be construed as aggressive or assault. And he did actually move out of the way for fear I might do it.
And there is where the power lies, folks. I love that tale. Get out of my way, else I'll kiss you.
What I didn't tell you is after that, I went down to meet the heavies, because they had a lorry down at one of the other gates. A big man, local farmer, who's known to spray shotgun fire, even if the police round, he just didn't care. His name was Mick, I think. And he had three or four youngsters, and they were clearly going in to do some beating up. So I went over to them, and I smiled sweetly and said to the kids, "Do your mums know you're here?" And the conversation did not go in the direction that they thought it would at all, because I was treating them like naughty children, and they responded like naughty children. And, you know, women who are sure of themselves just are not squashable.
Mm-hmm. I remember Jess Synchro telling me a story about when she was over in Nepal, where she spent a couple of years, and how there was quite a lot of stuff went on there that, I guess, is culturally different, but there are some things that you just have to respond to from your heart. And she was saying there was a night when she was awoken by the sound of a woman in distress, and basically Synchro's response was to shout out, you know, "What would your sister say?"
Yes.
And it's kind of simple and complex, isn't it? The most amazingly simple personal interventions can make a difference. You don't need to throw a fist.
No, you don't need to throw a fist. But you can be aggressively personal. And people need reminding of it. So, you know, I think I go back to this thing that I think older women are really the bee's knees when it comes to personal power.
I wouldn't stand in your way, mate.
No, you wouldn't. But it's not because I'm aggressive or nasty or anything like that. It's power to, not power over.
Yeah.
And I think that is the difference, because we're so used to power over that power to is a bit of a shock.
But it's what you're all about, isn't it? Is handing responsibility back to the individual that comes to you. And, I mean, do you find that everybody's willing to take the power to on board? Because this is kind of like the key of feminism, isn't it?
It is. No, of course they're not. Of course they're not. In many respects, what you can do is lay a little time bomb. You say something to somebody about their behaviour, and they go away, and it stays with them. And many's the time now that I've had a patient come back to me. The longest was 27 years later. So I've never forgotten what you told me, and you were right. You know, never underestimate the power of your words if they're spoken with that old-fashioned word, righteousness.
Sincerity and confidence.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
And I've had exactly the same experience now too many times to be ignored, where I've just simply had conversations with people who needed to be conversed with, and years later they've come up with that line that you've just given me, and I've never forgotten what you told me, and I'd forgotten it. And somehow, at some point, it's made the critical difference, which is kind of us operating outside time, isn't it?
Yes, and it's what elders are for. So we're back to family again now, breaking up families. So if we go all the way back to feminism again, I had an interesting experience. I had a Czech au pair when my son was little. And she was like a woman of the 50s from our culture, modest and demure and knowledgeable about children and cooking and domestic arts, and very sweet-natured and by no means cynical in any respect. And it was such a change from the way young women were around me at that time. And a lot of it was because they still grew up in giant extended families and there was always a role model on hand. Phase one of feminism, because I think these were all really, to a large extent, chivvied along by the Tavistock Clinic Institute. The idea that women had to strive for academic excellence and careers and not having children and being hard and being like men. It took so much away from the womanliness. And then I think about the dressing up. You know, most female creatures are drab compared to the males. We're not.
Surely that's a matter of opinion.
Well, it is to the females and the males concerned, yes.
Yeah.
You know, the women, think about peacocks. You know, peahens are a bit dull by comparison. You know, it's the men, that the males that do the display and the courtship. And the females are beautiful and valuable and precious. They are doing and the males, sorry, they are being and the males are doing. And it seems to me the fundamental roles of the genders, and I do think there are two genders depending on what sort of body you've got. Don't care who disagrees with me. I'm fed up with this gender argument. What you do with your bottom's your affair. But your body is male or female for the most part. And what seems to be the case is that, by and large, males do and females be.
Yeah, the way Chris Diogi puts it is that men draw the lines and women feel the field.
Okay, yep.
It's an interesting thought, isn't it?
It is, yes. John
so they, the women are basically giving direction to the line, which the men draw.
Yes. Well, John Donne got there. He said woman was the compass point and, the compass point and man was the pencil.
I'll tell you what, shall we leave a discussion of the metaphysical poets for another whole show?
For that, I'm very fond of them all.
John Donne. Wow, man. What a man.
Indeed. What a man. And then, just before we leave that, think what it was like before people were literate, because I'm turning against literacy, universal literacy these days. If you think that the amazing sermons that John Donne spoke at St. Paul's were very largely listened to by unlettered Londoners who could hear, they could absorb all that complexity orally as they could with Shakespeare. We can't do that now.
Complexity turns us off. I mean, as you know, we do community Shakespeare play every year. And the first thing that happens to the show is that a third of the script is cut away, partly because we're amateurs and amateurs are slow. So you'd end up with a 3-hour show if you left it in. But it also means you can remove all the topical and incomprehensible gags. And that leaves you with the script that drives the story forward. But for our purposes here, the crucial point is that then any famous speeches that are still involved that haven't been cut, and we never cut famous speeches, if there's a word that is likely to be unfamiliar or difficult to the audience, then it too will be cut and replaced with an easier word that scans and fits the Shakespearean stuff, because we've really realised that it is absolutely literally true. And believe me, on the stage, you can feel it happen. If you use a word that people don't understand, you lose half the audience. You can actually feel them from the stage switch off.
Yes. Well, anybody comes across a word they don't understand when they're reading, they miss the next two lines of script. Because they're processing their non-understanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they can't catch up.
Yeah. It's a bit of a problem, that.
Well, I mean, our way of... The most common thing we've heard outside the Willow Theatre over the years is, do you know that? I think that's the first time I've ever understood Shakespeare. And it's because of that approach right at the beginning to the script itself. What's left is immensely powerful, it has to be said, and very funny too. We've got a question from Jimmy in the chat box. Do you fancy taking one?
Yeah, sure.
It says, how does the guest feel about the feminist attacks on Emma Watson for her recent non-exposure of the boob for a mainstream celeb rag? Do you know what any of that's about?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. Would you expand on it, please?
There we go, Jimmy. If you expand on that, we'll go for that in a minute. It sounds like it's quite interesting, because the exposure of boobs in public, I realise, is a serious problem to some.
There's a lot being published about it at the moment. But you know,
what sort of thing are they publishing about women and their boobs in public?
Well, there's quite a lot of big stuff about whether women should have a right to feed their children in public. And apparently there's a movement to feed babies in public, which in America at least, men are going up to them and saying, that's disgusting. You know, put them away or I'll hit you and stuff like that. It's amazing. We're mammals. We're mammals. And it's all part of the gender bending and the confusion and the neutering. You know, that if you actually divide a mammalian baby from its mother, you know, what have you got that is healthy animal?
The first time I really came across this was, we've got a kind of local bar that does all sorts of things like pizza baking, you know, you can make your own pizza topping, and they've got bread baking and beer brewing, but they've got a breastfeeding club. And it just struck me as a completely bizarre idea, but of course they don't actually want offspring to be feeding from the breast at all, let alone in public.
Well, no, they don't. I mean, it's got so many advantages that are not desirable, like good health and bonding and young women growing up into mums. You know, how can you grow up into a mum if you don't mother?
Yeah, and of course we're going to get in the second half of the show into just exactly what modern mothering is. But here's Jimmy's posted a really useful link from The Guardian. It's entitled Emma Watson on Vanity Fair Cover. Feminism is about giving women choice. And then the little summary is also, it's moving a bit quick from his screen. The actor, she's presumably an actress, but anyway, the actor Emma Watson has hit back at critics who say she has betrayed her feminist ideals by posing for a revealing picture in Vanity Fair magazine in which parts of her breasts were exposed. Oh my God, what do you reckon to that? Isn't that shocking?
If we all took our clothes off and just wandered about, it would be so much easier. You know, when I was about 20, a friend of mine took me down to the Isle of Wight, and she only told me when we were on the ferry that the place we were going to stay was a nudist camp. And it was one of the most interesting experiences I've ever had, because it took me 3 days, actually, to get down to it, as it were. But by that time, I'd realised how lovely bodies are. Nearly everybody there was over 50. Most of them were not what you'd call elegant bodies. But there were happy ones, and there were smiley ones, and there were sad ones, and there were long, thin, droopy ones. And it stopped mattering remarkably quickly. What mattered was the eloquence with which bodies expressed their owners or their inhabitants.
We're massively divorced from each other by the fact that we can't see that, and it only occurred to me when you made the initial comment in this particular bit of the conversation that, of course, most of the things we cover ourselves with are also products of the oil industry.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Nick Nomick's put in the chat book, he's put parts of her breasts, but the witch. Which again will turn out to be bang on.
I think our bodies have been taken away from us. Never mind all this display stuff. It's so rigid what you're not allowed to display, and it's all supposed to be titivating. And the whole point about bodies is that they're just flesh. Mm. And because I had that particular experience, I feel very differently about bodies now. And I'm really into modesty because I think it's much more interesting.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, you can be perfectly modest with none of your clothes on. Just as I don't think Madonna could be modest even if she was wearing a wimple.
So how long did you stay at your nudist camp then, Stella?
I think we're there about a week.
It's enough time to make a big difference. I've never tried that myself. In fact, I'll admit it's never even occurred to me, though it just has.
Well, I never would have wanted to, but since I found myself there, what did you to do? You know, I would stick out far more. Sorry, I would be far more conspicuous, I should say, with clothes on than clothes off.
Yeah.
But it was such a nice, life-enhancing experience just to have a body functioning as a body. And it was surprisingly sexless.
Isn't that the ultimate feminism?
Yes.
So where did neo-feminism take us then?
Well, I think the first wave of feminism had fallen by the wayside, and women were starting to go back to being decent humans again, perhaps. So we needed another wave of it. But this isn't feminism. This is turning all women into prostitutes, isn't it? Pretty much.
That's what it looks like to me.
I feel the only form of sexuality which isn't being celebrated at the moment is celibacy.
Which is a funny thing, because that's a decision that I personally took at the end of the last millennium, that was a pretty good solution to all the confusion, and I've stuck with that, and it's worked very well for me.
Yes, exactly. And it doesn't actually imply lack of relationships.
Quite the contrary. One of the things I've noticed as a result of that decision is that for some reason society places a lot of emphasis on the one person with whom we might share a bed or a towel, and no emphasis on anybody else, whereas in fact, of course, the vast majority of our relationships, and it must be massive, 99 point loads, are thingy, what they call it, platonic, that's it, like the geometry, but sex.
Yes. That's one way, one very good way to put it. Yeah, I mean, just as all our relationships can be seen as having a sexual bearing because we are reproductive creatures, what is interesting is what is missing is the dimensions of genuine commitment to other humans for love, not for sex. And I think encouraging anxious codependency in a sexual sense, so that couples, if they are going to be couples, are constantly needing to try and be everything for each other. I mean, it's lunatic, really.
What seems to me to be basically happening is that there's a model of codependence that is being subtly implied, inferred, and introduced, and it's that codependency that leads to collapse, because to a great extent relationships are not exploring themselves to the point where they achieve co-creative status, where you've got through the difficult bits, you've learnt from a load of potential breakdowns about breakthroughs, you know each other well, and you're willing to take the world on and work and realise the co-potential of two people that know each other well. It's been, it seems to me, cut off before it gets to that stage in more or less, to all extent and purposes, all cases. What?
That's very interesting, Ben. And it takes me back to a thought I had about the loss of village life. If you live in a village and you've lived with the same people all your life, you not only have great skills in friendships and family, you should have great skills in disliking relationships, or relationships of dislike and unlike and positive hatred. And you learn how to handle them and live with it. And I think one of the side effects of losing that long-term community stableness is that people no longer have the ability to deal with difficulties in friendships. If it gets rough, they turn round and leave and find some more friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
So with your partnerships, then, there is less experience in working through difficulties, and that makes for easier divorce, easier separation, easier pain, more vindictiveness, less understanding.
And the sacrifice of the relationships that are most likely to be useful to you, because you know more about the people that you're working with, and you have at least endeavoured to achieve greater things with them than you have with all of the millions of other people with whom you're not sharing a towel or a bed.
Significant others.
That's what they call them.
Mm.
I've got millions of them. That's the other thing that happens if you don't choose a particular significant other, is that you can have a lot of them. Yes. And by that I mean I'm not sharing towels and beds with millions of people.
No, but you're sharing parts of your life and depths, aren't you?
It's where we're going, frankly, Stella. You know, the internet relationships we've built up and stuff are all to do with networks that need to be networked with each other. Actually, true effectiveness is only being achieved on the ground with people, eyeball to eyeball, pheromone to pheromone, working together.
Back to communities.
Absolutely right. There's going to be a lot of that, I think, on the show in the near future. So we're talking about an initial wave of feminism, which was probably really genuinely and biologically motivated to take us back to where men and women are supposed to be. That, as is normally the case with such things, it was being a natural drive and a movement that was unstoppable. You might as well use the Aikido principle, the CIA think, and we'll grab it and we'll throw it around a bit. What came out of that is a kind of, is this what we might call neo-feminism. I have a bit of difficulty, I must admit, getting my head round this. Can you perhaps give me some sort of description as to what an archetypal neo-feminist attitude might say to me were I to encounter it down a pub or whatever?
No.
We love the difficult questions. I know you're up for it, though.
Oh, yes. Can I answer it with another story?
Go for it. People love anecdotes, you know.
Do they? Oh, well, this is a cool one. I went to a wedding recently, and I have to say, I don't like weddings.
Satanic rituals, not to my taste, you know.
No. After you've lived with someone 50 years, maybe it might be worth getting married to them and saying, yeah, I think you'll do. But I went to this wedding, and the older women were all upholstered into their clothes and wearing fascinators and brutal shoes. You know, really high-heeled, spiky, pointy, horrible, unpleasant, unfoot-like things. They all looked absolutely radiant with plastic, you know, layers and layers of makeup, and I was invited to go and get my eyelids threaded the night before. Or
what is that? I've seen a poster for threading. What is it? Oh, sorry to distract you.
That's all right. It is something to do with tying little bits of cotton into your eyelids, not eyelashes.
Into your eyelids? It's a way of
thinning your eyelids.
What? What's that say? It's just even more bizarre.
It sounds like medieval torture to me, but, you know, one must suffer to be beautiful, evidently.
There you go. So you went and got yourself threaded.
No, I didn't. I turned up on the day of the wedding in my usual clothes, which are neat and sort of a bit medieval, perhaps. I wasn't upholstered into them. And I didn't have hair like a helmet with all this glue stuck on it. And it was the embodiment of the dream. You know, the amount of money spent on fares to the wedding and clothes for the wedding and the venues and all that would have paid off these people's fucking mortgage. But it was the day. It was the day for being a princess. And
one day, guys, enjoy it, because it's only one day.
I have waited for this day all my life. I am going to have my moment. The camera is going to be on me. The camera was the guest of honour at this day. Everything was done so that the camera could see.
Another strange and relatively modern idea.
Absolutely, yes. It was all lined up, ready to show your confetti so that the camera can see you. The food was pretty dire. Everybody was grossly uncomfortable as far as I could see. And it was bizarre because all of it was... Who was it who had that wonderful expression of everyone wanting their 5 minutes of fame? Was it Andy Warhol?
Yes, it was Andy Warhol.
This was the bride's day of fame, and she was centre stage all day. And that is the neo-feminism. That is me dressed up, the cynosure of every eye, you know, holding centre stage, being given to vast amounts of gifts and love and warmth and claps. And of course, it all went straight on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the real point of it.
Massive me, 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 me.
Yeah, that is the modern wave of feminism, as far as I can see. It has nothing to do with being a real, sweating, tired, sore-footed woman.
Nick Nomic says, sounds about average for a wedding so far. Was there a fight later?
Well, yes, but, you know, if we're talking about Satanism, I think that the core of Satanism has to be something like being completely disconnected from the needs, loves and wants of other people and living in this completely self-centered dream.
That's the point, isn't it?
Whoever doesn't conform to it has to be attacked. And perhaps that's why when marriages go wrong, some of the women become so vituperative, is because their dream has been destroyed.
Well, it's never going to be like that. The real progress comes through challenge and potential breakdown.
But if they have no concept of that, you know, then everything is downhill, isn't it? From the moment of the wedding. And the babies don't just lie in their cots and smile all the time. They have needs, and they have needs when, you know, you're tired and want to go to bed. And
so then does the husband.
Yeah, exactly. And this is not to be allowed, because the princess, of course, nobody ever requires anything of her in the fantasy. And I think that's why, if you go back to Disney characters, isn't it interesting that all the, this is a point made by someone else, all the Disney feminine characters are all orphans. So they have no responsibilities to anyone except themselves.
God, is that, I mean, I know there's a lot of the Disney things, when you look closely at them, are just really not at all what they appear to be, which is so shocking. But I think you're right.
He was known as a Satanist. There's no question of it. He was.
Yeah. And okay, we've done the neo-feminist thing. Before we have a quick music break, let's do the Satanist thing, because it's really important. This, we've talked before with several people about satanic ritual abuse, and I've noticed in private eye that the whole idea of abuse at all, let alone ritual abuse, gets discounted because of the use of the word satanic. And I've had quite long conversations with my friend and co-host Freeman Jack about the use of the word satanic. And we're talking about it, I think, more in the Freeman Jack sense of it here. Would you like to try and outline what we mean by satanic for the purposes of this discussion?
Well, I've been thinking about this.
That's why you're the interviewee, you know, and I'm the guy that asks the questions.
Beautifully, Ben. You really do. Okay. If anybody has never read it, or most people haven't read it these days, but one of the best examples of Satanism is The History of Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe.
Hey, man, do you want to know? One of the first major parts I was given was Dr. Faustus. I 1,400 lines of blank verse in a proscenium arch with a big wind-powered organ and all of that. It was massive. I love Dr. Faustus, but I'll leave it to you for the moment.
It's my favourite play. It's always been my favourite play.
Helen ended up being my girlfriend for 3 or 4 years.
Sorry?
Helen of Troy ended up being my girlfriend for 4 years, having performed Dr. Faustus with her. That's obviously the lady with whom one performs necromancy. Was this the face that launched 1,000 ships and burned the topless towers of Ilium? Sweet Helen, make me immortal with a kiss. I remember it even now, you see.
Amazing. Wonderful, wonderful play. What it's about, basically, is a man of great intelligence and sensitivity seduced by having everything he wanted. And he had everything he wanted. He had Helen of Troy. He had riches. He had success and fame. And the most interesting part of the play is when he has but one bare hour to live, and Mephistopheles comes to get him, and he suddenly realizes he hasn't had what he wanted at all. And I think it's one that, that last speech is one of the most profound in the English language.
It's absolutely great. He calls on the whole cosmos to swallow him up.
Yes, stand still, ye ever-moving spheres of heaven, that time may cease and midnight never come. Yeah, but the point is, it is the sly salesman, it is the advertising executive, it is Satan getting behind or in front of Jesus saying, I will give you the whole world. That is the Satan.
That's right, and Satan is the opposer of what we might call the Christ consciousness. We need to suspend our kind of prejudices and place where Christ consciousness, as the phrase is, whatever phrase it is, we find acceptable for that. But that is what Satanism is. It is the opposition of beauty and truth. And it is the me attitude that takes absolutely no account of anybody else from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. And when I go to sleep at night, I'm thinking of me. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm thinking of me. And I don't, in the interim, have time to think about supply, resource, help, or consider anybody that's not me. And under those circumstances, there's a few fucking Satanists about in there.
Yes, aren't there just? Because in the end, it's like the last moments of the Twin Towers, the messages that came out. All of them were about love. Every single one. So when these selfish fucking bankers were dying, they realised. You know, in the end, I think what Satanism does is it takes those moments of truth right the way up to when you're dying. And then if you're morphined into death so you can't be conscious, you never get there. But the point of religion, it seems to me it's not about any particular religion. It's about coming to terms with some very simple truths, which you can see in any kindergarten. People are happier if they give. People are happier if they love. People are happier if they're kind. But we have no right to happiness or security or to expect life to give us everything on the plate. And happiness is not in things. You know, like the Dalai Lama says, evil comes from using people and loving things. And what we need to do is love people and use things. And it goes all the way down to such things as how we manage our husbandry. You know, if you have a flock of sheep or a flock of cows, herd of cows, and you take care of them, then you're husbanding them. You're not producing meat. Speaking as a rampant carnivore, you know, I don't eat meat unless it's had a happy life and been well treated. And preferably I know where it comes from exactly.
If that was only true of all husbands, eh?
If it was only true. You're quite right. But in a sense, we're talking about children know what the values are in life. If they were offered things or mummy, they would always generally turn to mummy pretty quickly. But, you know, they go through a phase of cupidity and wanting things, and that is fostered and fostered and fostered until the infantilized child who has always been told what to think and what to do and what to want doesn't recognize the love anymore.
Yep. And that, I think, we'll go to after our imminent music break. But just as I was about to go to it, and he kind of distracted me from what you just said there. So if you can kind of remember it for when we played the music. Because Jimmy said, Doc, how come... And Jimmy, by the way, said that he spent something like 3 months in a nudist camp in Spain. So he's, like, really happy to hear you talking about it. But here he goes... How come our feminist guest is comfortable using the term husbandry? Thanks, Jimmy. You're a darling. Off you go, Stella.
Because feminism is a state of mind. I'm very domestic myself. I have my liberations, and I went back to the kitchen sink because I'm very happy there. It's freedom is in the mind. And, you know, what is wrong with a good husband?
Yeah, I must admit, perhaps it's partly the feminism of the masculine, feminization of the masculine or whatever, that I'm bloody happy at the kitchen sink too. I love it there.
Yeah. I mean, I will happily teach any man how to make his own shirts. And then if he's busy and he's very willing to mend my car, I will mend his shirts for him, if that's the way it goes. Because, you know, I find increasingly as I get older, I have a lot of traditional feminine skills, and I like practicing them. And yes, I used to mend my own motorbike, but I don't have to do it anymore. And anyway, I always used to paint my nails before I started, and I never worked out what that was for.
No, let alone all the various tattoo puncturing and nail bars, hair stylists, and all the rest that are kind of... popping up around the place. Do you know, Stella, I really can't imagine you with painted nails unless you'd got some really sharp-eyed youngster to paint something that was worth seeing on them.
The best prescription I ever made with painted nails was a pianist I knew who was a very good pianist, but he did bite his nails and it was terrible. And I said, okay, well, my prescription for you is paint your nails scarlet every time you bite them and you will go on television with scarlet nails. And you know, he stopped biting them.
Simple solutions for biting your nails. What a great cue for a music break. I think, well, I really, man, that was a great little conversation. We've got a long way to go with it after a bit of music, but I sent to Stella before the show, I sent her, everybody out there knows that I love Tracy Curtis. She does these beautiful little 2.5-3 minute poignant songs. And I want to play now Raising Boys and Girls, because it's going to highlight, the lyrics really going to highlight where we might want to revenue our decisions and what it is we're doing at the moment. I was going to follow it with Love Truncheon from Eat Static, because I like a bit of contrast, but as it is, because my lovely guest Stella mentioned the Yorkley Court Farm, I'm going to play Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith's Ballad of Yorkley Court Farm, which also sinks nicely into the show. And because one of the bits of the broadcast that's still not working is I can't talk to Stella when we're playing tunes, it means we can't distract ourselves and perhaps she'll listen to the music, and when we come back we'll be able to have a bit of a chat about that and find out, just try and pin down where this neo-feminism, Satanism, me thing applies, because it's one of the easiest things to deal with once we recognise it. If we don't know it's there, we're not going to even think about that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to play Raising Boys and Girls by Tracy Curtis. You've got about 8 or 10 minutes or so, and then we'll slip into part two. But here we go. Press the right buttons, and back with you in a few minutes or so.
Okay, lovely.
Bring up your sons to love their mums. Sisters, girlfriends, daughters should be raised as equals. Voices heard, bringing strong women into the world who in turn will raise their sons.
Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith and the Ballad of Yorkley Court. Possibly one of the finest songs ever written, really, and they blocked the gates, not just with everything they had, but they actually blocked the gates with tonight's guest, Stella Berg, the Kissing Granny. Are you still there?
I am indeed. What lovely music you play.
Well, when I have lovely guests on, it's easy to match the music to the guest, you see, that's what it is. I'm just, I've just got, it's brilliant, that Yorkley Court thing. We really wanted to come down there, and then they just took it all apart. And that song by, I'm sure, our mutual friends, Jimmy Aldrich and Sid Goldsmith, but also by Humphrey Lloyd, who came on the show. It really says it all, you know, until the world is owned, the land's owned by none, and the fruits are owned by all, we're fecked.
Yes. Well, the time will come. The time will come, I'm sure of it. I think we're winning, you know. Having spent many years looking at all the disasters going on, I think we're winning at the moment, and I feel very optimistic about the future.
Yeah, I agree. I feel that way as well. I mean, I do, I must admit, have days when I really just think it's too far gone. But by and large, when I think about the potential of getting people like us and the people that are listening to this show and sticking them in a place where they can actually debate some of the serious issues with some of the, what we might call the great and good or whatever, it just absolutely beat the pants off them just in the debating chamber without a problem because they don't know what they're doing, right? So if we were to actually unleash that potential genius onto the land and with the people and with the music and doing the things that we wanted to do, then the potential's just massive.
I think I was talking with someone about this the other night. Guy Taylor, actually. or was it Pete? No, it was Pete Kroll.
He said he dropped in.
Yeah, he did. Nice to see him always. What is needed, for example, with the justice system is simply to start ignoring it. Jung had this really wonderful image of what you do in an insoluble situation. And I've always imaged it like having a huge, great satellite dish bang in the middle of your visual field and you can't get past it. You can't do anything. It's there blocking your way. And what you have to do, he says, is you simply move further up the mountain. The insoluble problem remains insoluble, but the further up you go, the less of your landscape it takes up until it's irrelevant.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of really great points that bring to mind. One is a visit, and it appears completely unrelated, but it's not. A visit I made to the London Planetarium, where they had this massive kind of screen and a little red circle on the ground. And if you stood in this red circle that was just big enough for your feet, you could see Orion. But if you went anywhere else that wasn't in the red circle, Orion's stars were separated from each other. And I can't remember what the second point was. Might come back to me.
Yeah. It's all about your perspective, isn't it?
I just remembered what the second point was, and it was a really good one, which is if you're trained to ride a motorcycle, one of the basic things they'll teach you is that if there's two machines crashing in front of you, don't look at the crash, look at the hedge, because you'll go to the hedge. If you look at the crash, you'll go to the crash.
I've never heard that before, but I love it.
It's great, isn't it? It's pretty bang to rights.
Yeah.
Where consciousness flows, action goes.
Yep, indeed it does. Gosh. Well, I think these people are becoming irrelevant. That's the point.
Yep.
And we need to get them more irrelevant and get on with our own living patterns and restoring natural patterns to who we are. And I think that's happening. Have you heard what's happening with the Schumann resonance? Do you know about that?
I do know, yes, that it's rising.
Well, it's rising and it's risen so far, for your listeners. The Schumann resonance is like the music of the spheres. It's the music of Earth. And I don't know anything about this physics stuff, but, it's the speed at which the Earth vibrates. And it's always been 7 hertz. Which in humans equates to being deeply asleep, doesn't it? Or in trance?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, yeah, well beyond deeply asleep, 7 hertz, I think.
And it's always been like that. But in the last year or two, it's gone up to 47. And I don't know if it's going to still be moving, but it's gone up to a point where if we resonate in tune to the planet, as we do, for example, if you listen to heartbeat music and the heartbeat speeds up, in horror movies, they do that all the time.
Violins work well.
That's right. We resonate with it. So if we resonate with the Schumann resonance of the planet and it's gone up to 47, that is alert, attentive, learning wakefulness.
And that's, of course, exactly what I suspect we're being distracted from by all of this activity and stuff. Just like T.S. Eliot said, light. Oh, hang on a minute, there's Stella coming back in. Oh, did we lose you there?
I'm so sorry, I pressed a button.
Oh, that's all right. It came back on pretty quickly. I was just filling in with a bit of T.S. Eliot, being as we hit on John Donne earlier, and a bit from, I think, the Four Quartets, where he says, the flicker of light over strained, time-ridden faces, distracted from distraction by distraction.
Oh, I don't know that one. That's lovely.
Isn't it great?
Wow. Let me just savour that for a moment.
It's what's basically happening to us. We're the planet, whatever's going, something's going on, and it's all resonance-based. We're moving from kind of, we appear to be moving in loads of different ways from low frequency to high frequency. And the entire effort of the world management team is directed, Bernays and Freud and Huxley and the whole blood, Darwin, the whole bloody lot of them, is to make us think that that's not happening. But happening it is, and those ancient ancestors of ours that so wisely set their stone circles where they set them and stuff were aware of that. So it is a physical thing, it is happening, and the world management team are definitely on the losing side. That's what I think, anyway.
Yes, I agree with that. One of my teachers used to say that the reason there are so many humans on the planet is we're all here this time. Everyone wants a ringside seat to see if we manage now. Because he reckoned the last time this happened was when Atlantis sank. And humans failed to make the threshold into full consciousness. But I think perhaps we're going to make it this time.
Yes, because, again, we're relatively old people. And, I mean, basically, I've seen many of the same things happen at least three times whilst I've been here. And I'm really happy to assume that's happening on a bigger scale. And that, that you can't hold on to power by coercing and threatening people. That has been shown many, many times over the years. And at some point, that little cycle that's been recognized so many times is going to apply on an absolutely massive holographic scale, fractal scale. And the immovable object and unstoppable force thing that you referred to earlier. One of the things I really love is an old riddle, which is what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. Do you know, just as a matter of interest?
What the answer is?
Yeah.
The answer is anything we want it to be. What's your answer?
That's exactly right, but the technical scientism answer is that the unstoppable force stops, the immovable force moves, and everything changes. Nothing that was true is true anymore. And that's what they call a tipping point. And that's why we spent so much money on the ticket.
Okay. I like that. That's worth thinking about.
In the meantime, we were talking about Satanism and the me attitude, and we were applying it particularly to feminism, and this has resulted in the honest bringing up of offspring in a given way that is been going on for a long time and is not necessarily to our advantage. Do you want to give us a few thoughts on that?
Ooh, where do we start? Okay, well, self-interested, self-centered mothers. The amount of suffering involved. You know, mothers who would rather put on their makeup than attend to their children, and who leave their kids at home and go away for 2 weeks and leave them with sandwiches.
Who give their children for the first 50,000 hours of their education to a bunch of total strangers.
and never inquire what they're teaching them. We have just accepted so many layers and layers and layers of improbability. The first one being, why would you not want to spend your lives with your tribe? You know, with your men and women and their children, all just getting on with their lives.
Well, it's because that gets, that's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, but before the Industrial Revolution, it didn't happen.
No.
You know, but we've accepted these layers and layers and layers of abnormality, and passed them on to our children and our grandchildren. And we no longer know what is normal and reasonable and right. I mean, what I find interesting is 40 years ago, I was really far out because I wore, you know, hand-knitted socks and home-baked bread and, you know, all that stuff.
Hey, man, you're back in, you're trending, mate. You're trending.
Indeed, I am. I am now not only normal, I'm quite desirable in some ways. Generations come and sit at my feet and find out how to knit bread. You know, it's great. But that's why I think things are changing, because we're almost dividing into the Morks and the Watsits.
Yeah, quite slow.
Only the Watsits are the really beautiful painted ones, and the Morks are the peasants with their hands in the dirt. All the clues have been laid out in front of us, haven't they? All the myths have been given to us. And I think the Satanism thing is taking people away from the nourishing root of ordinariness. You know, my greatest compliment to anyone has long been to say they're ordinary. I give that compliment to very few people because everyone's trying to be extraordinary. You know, it's very refreshing to come across someone who's simply being without any adjectives.
And the thing is that most people don't kind of really get to try that. And if they do, they're quite often already conditioned by the soap opera mentality, which makes it impossible for them to pull it off. You know, it's the business of working with people and getting on with them pretty much no matter what they think, because everybody's got special needs and everybody's specially enabled and all that, is like, it's the only way we can make progress. When that, what's that phrase that, you know, when you're tired of all the noise and clamour or whatever, and you're willing to face the one in the mirror, that, I don't think that's referring to your face in the mirror, although it is doing that. What it's referring to is how other people mirror your attitudes. And that's where the real mirror is, getting on with other people to do something useful. And somehow we appear to have utterly forgotten that that's what we're here for.
One of the ways I would like to characterise this, it's a game I play with patients quite often, is using the myths of the Greek gods and goddesses. What we've been tied into is perpetually stuck in Aphrodite with little dots of Athene here and there, if that makes any sense. Aphrodite was very sexy, but she always lost her man in the end.
Wasn't she the one that rolled the golden apple into the party of the gods that she'd invited, saying, who is the most beautiful? And there was just like a riot. Wasn't that Aphrodite's apple? Or am I mistaken?
Do you know, it escapes me. I can't remember at all.
Okay, we'll look it up for the next one, but I think that's what happened. She was kind of like a Discordian, and she kind of lobbed this up. She arranged for all the chief Olympian gods to meet each other, and she rolled this golden apple in there with the question, who is the most beautiful, written on it, and there was just carnage. And if not, it's a very clever Dr. Rock myth. Write it down. You heard it here first.
Yep. Worth pursuing, I think. There's something to it, but I can't remember what the story was. But what I was thinking was, we have lost Hera. We've lost all respect for Hera. Or Juno. You know, chief god's wife. She was the Lady WI. She was pillar of the community. She was the bastion of respectability and the arbiter of morals. And she has been lost completely out of sight because she is the one that carries on the nature of the culture. And she, you know, the grandmother is subsumed inside that goddess figure. But so also is the respectable matron.
And that is why the neo-feminist agenda is to control the minds of the women first.
Yes, because the women are basic to that. And Hera is the only goddess who brought up her own children, as far as I know. So women are allowed to be Diana, the huntress, the feminist, virgin goddess, which in Greek terms just meant wasn't attached to a partner. It didn't mean asexual. Or Athene, so intellectual. Or most of them actually are Persephone, the little girl who never grows up and is a spoilt brat.
Which, of course, is kind of what most husbands hope they're going to get.
Well, if they haven't, if it grows up, then they go and marry the next generation of one, don't they?
Have we not seen this happening a few times?
I think we have. But the more mature goddesses don't get a place. And of course, the one that's been completely forgotten is Hestia, who is the goddess of the hearth, the Vestal Virgin, the mystic, the inward-looking, you know, the psychic, being completely lost.
The kind of woman that makes you really nervous.
Well, she shouldn't.
No, indeed. I mean,
she should be imposing and intimidating out of her own right. But, you know, that's respect.
And in John Donne's stuff, she was the muse.
Yes, of course she was.
In the metaphysical scheme of things.
Yes.
It's part of this kind of alchemical engine that's driven by the male and the female together, working together.
And that's the whole battle of the sexes stuff instead of the alliance of the sexes. So then if you look at the male gods, you know, Hephaestus is the one that most men need to go through. He was the crippled god, and he was the only worker amongst them, because he was the creative one. He was the maker. He was the original blacksmith.
And that's the other thing that the neo-feminist agenda does, is that it cripples the man. And that's the grail myth, and, you know, the man who's wounded through the thigh. It's all of this stuff, so it's very ancient, isn't it, it seems to me.
It is very ancient, and I think the idea is that all men need to be either an Apollo or a Ganymede, and Ganymede is a big one because Ganymede was the first sort of bisexual amphibian. So you know that you've lost the range of masculinity and femininity, and then I think you shouldn't forget that it was Freud who awoke the old story of Oedipus, and I'm less and less as the years go by, less and less do I believe in the myth of Oedipus. I don't think children do have sexuality. I think they have sensuality, which is a completely different thing. I think they love their bodies and they love exploring, and they have no boundaries to stop them exploring anything.
No, that's true, but at the same time, I'd say that the sort of doctors and nurses games, shall we say, show that even from quite an early age, there is a drive of some sort there.
They have all the components of sexuality, but they don't come together until a certain point in their development. How could it be otherwise?
You're a long way away, even from when the consciousness of it starts arriving in your head, you're a long way away from actually being able to manifest it. So maybe the doctors and nurses games, I don't know when they start, what, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, but it's not till you're, I mean, obviously I can only do this from a male perspective, but it's possibly not till you're 11, 12, 13 that you start considering trying to kiss something.
Well, it's a bit scary, isn't it?
It all depends on... It's not, I mean, fucking hell, excuse my French, but it's a damn sight more scary, actually, than you know it is when you're only 11.
Yes. so much depends on children's upbringing and their environment. But, you know, I spent many, many years working with children in care and in schools and obviously lots of children as patients. And I think the only approach of Freud's that I would go with is the idea of polymorphous perverse, which is a really stupid name. Which simply means active, lively curiosity.
My friend John Preston of the John Preston Tribute Band says polymorphous. What was the word phrase you had there?
Polymorphous perversity.
That's right. He said polymorphous perversity. It scared the shit out of me.
I wonder what he means by that.
Yeah, he's a funny man, he is. So we're kind of in a position where it's really basically simple, it seems to me. Although we talk about feminism, neo-feminism, Satanism, and the family, what we're actually talking about is the old, old, long-vanished skill of getting on with people and exploring that fundamentally for our own development, because that's where the mirror is. Is this not the kind of simple pivot on which all of this complexity is balanced?
Can I slightly redefine that? I like the old Quaker expression of finding that of God in everyone. Because then you can find it in yourself.
Because everyone is the reflection of yourself.
Yes. But also, you know, God has become such a dirty word, hasn't it? If you replace the word God with consciousness, finding the spark in other people to love and respect and to treat them as other with whom one can share or discuss experience with and go deeper and deeper and deeper. Because other people can show you things at the back of your head that you can't see.
Because they're your mirror.
Yes. You know, we give our best gifts to other people and then find years later that that was a gift given to ourselves as well.
And they're also giving their best gifts to other people, and we can be the recipients of that and maybe not recognise that until several years down the line.
That's right. So we're back to the subtle twisting of the Satan people, which is that what they've changed over is from the pleasures of giving into the pleasures of taking, or receiving has been changed into taking.
Oh, that's small and subtle, isn't it? But totally all-encompassing.
Yeah, because in order to receive, you have to be in tune with the person, don't you? Whereas in order to take, you just grab. And it's a lesson all small children learn between 2 and 4. They start off grabbing and saying, mine. And after a while, they learn to say, would you like to play with my dolly?
Yeah, these children understand. These grown-ups just don't get it.
They've had it kicked out of them, that's why. But, you know, children who are happy and well-balanced and developing nicely, they go through that phase of determined possessiveness. And I think a large number and amount of the population have got stuck in that phase. So they never got beyond the gimme gimme point, because all around them is all this stimulus to, all you have to do is reach out and take it and never mind the other person's feelings.
And the economic model is for some to grab as much as they can, as fast as they can, at the expense of everybody else. That is what the economic model is. It doesn't matter what they try to dress it up as. And so, what is a small child to do?
Copy its parents.
And that's what we've been doing. When you sent me to set this show off, you sent me a really great link, which I'm sure I can just find, hold on a moment, which was, it was a Mark Passio vid. About half an hour long, it's called Mark Passio, Satanic Feminism Has Destroyed the Family Dynamic. And he sticks loads of some of the best screenshots I've seen of quotes and stuff up there. And it's like you suddenly kind of realise that you were brought up in a dynamic, or I was brought up in a dynamic where basically the message was, what you need to do is get a good job and get as much money as you can. That's what Mark Passio said. That's exactly what happened to me. And then to the women, what you want is the bloke with a load of money. And of course, the money is simply a liability exchanged for goods and services. And nobody knew about that when they taught me. Now, when I think back to, I know there were schools a long time ago, 1500, 1600, but they really became established through the church around kind of like 1800 or so. That means we've had now seven generations of people who believe that actually going to work and getting repaid with a bit of debt or whatever is good enough. So it's really not a question of fault or anything, because it's like fucking 200 years old or something. We were taught what our parents were taught by their parents, and if anything's got to change, it's surely got to be that, hasn't it?
The schooling?
Yeah. And the business that we're not, like, I felt I had a really good education, because that's what I was taught, and by the standards of the day it was. But I wasn't taught about meditation, I wasn't taught about yoga, I wasn't taught about loads of things. It's, in fact, like one of the slides says in the Mark Passio video, hey children, we're here, but, well, I paraphrase, but it basically says, hey, we're here to teach you a load of shite, but pretty soon they'll invent the internet and you can find out the truth for yourself. So you can either stay in it or move on, can't you?
Do you think the internet was a mistake?
No, not by and large. I think that probably sensible people are starting to walk a bit backwards, though.
Mm. Yes. Well, it's given us the possibility of seeing this control system that's all around us, hasn't it?
It has, and we have the choice as to what to do about it. And I really think that it's a kind of mixture between the two for me. But fundamentally, the thing is meeting people eye to eye, working with them, and finding out what we've got to learn from each other. The internet is a kind of background useful thing that might introduce us to people who we could soon do with meeting, actually physically, and that we need to be, I feel, we need to be pursuing those connections and networking those networks as quickly and as soon as possible. But the real strength is in the physical networks, and pretty soon we're all going to know each other.
Mm-hmm. This is about making technology our servant rather than our master, isn't it?
It is, really, yeah. Or maybe even allowing technology to be a reminder of what we can actually do without all of the gold and the corporations and all this kind of stuff. We can do it anyway. It's just reminding us this is how we used to run things. We all knew what we were all thinking.
Yes. But I think we're getting there. I was having a lovely conversation with someone earlier this evening. But supposing artificial intelligence really takes off and becomes conscious, the one thing we've never been allowed to think about is that if robots and so forth and computers became conscious, they would probably end up being extremely ethical and compassionate, because it's the most efficient way to be.
I would have thought they're unlikely to turn out acting the way humans do. I mean, I'm not sure whether the computers could be asked to pay taxes so that people can repay an imaginary debt and fight wars. But maybe, hey, maybe that's how they'll turn out. Hope not.
It wouldn't be interesting if they turned out to be the angels.
Wouldn't it just? Wouldn't it just? I think at this point we could probably...
demon-like it's all been, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, I still feel that for all the apparent mayhem, that what's actually going on here is a massive and totally unexpected coming together, a really, really unlooked for outbreak of civil order. And that's what I personally am working for, because I think it's going to happen anyway, and I'd like to be on the winning side, because, you know, I'm a bit of a bigot that way.
I think love is breaking out.
Yeah, not for the first time, thankfully.
Not for the first time, but perhaps for the last.
Yes.
You know, I, more and more, I'm coming to a sort of metaphysical place where I think, you know, all these stories about imprisoning demons deep in the earth forever and ever, and if there are baddies, you know, whether they're Nephilim or anybody else on the planet, then there are likely to be goodies as well, you know.
It's got to be that way.
We keep having a very depressing view of it all. I have a feeling. Did you ever read Out of the Silent Planet, C.S. Lewis's trilogy?
No, but it's C.S. Lewis I haven't read.
It's been long lost, hasn't it? It's a science fiction trilogy.
I'd never even heard of it, and I really like C.S. Lewis, so I thought I'd read all his stuff. There you go.
Well, I think it's been suppressed, like so many of the writers from the 1940s and 50s, because they told it that were talking about this sort of thing. So he was talking about how Earth was called the Silent Planet because it had been put under interdict because it was contaminated with bad people.
Really?
And it wasn't the poor Earth people's fault. They had bad entities here. So this chap who goes on the first spaceship, I forget how he gets there, but he ends up going to Mars and Venus and stuff and meets all the entities there, and they're all full of light and goodness and hope and compassion, and they say, we're so sorry for you in that hideous planet because you've been possessed and you know, we can't let you loose on the solar system because you're destructive.
It's really easy, isn't it, that is, because you say, hey, man, it's all right. We don't mind all of that, because if we weren't on such a planet, we wouldn't have Motorhead, and we wouldn't have Speed, and we wouldn't have Harley Davidsons, and Fender Stratocasters, and valve amplifiers, and somewhere to plug the amps. Those are all products of where we are, and that's cool.
Well, I have great struggles about the egotism of this thought. But just as I think, for some reason, the British Isles are a strange and special place, so I think the Earth is a strange and special place too. And I rather like the idea that there was a book called Earth, the Only Planet of Choice.
A brilliant book. I enjoyed that.
Ah, there. You see, I think there might be a point to us being the experiment of free will to see what happens.
Yeah.
We are now going through or almost finished going through our spotty adolescence, and we may emerge into being a full-blown adult race.
We're only about to find out what free will is, because we haven't, in our voluntary slavery, we haven't really had any for a while or so.
No, but isn't there a thirst for it amongst the awakening?
Isn't there just?
You know, to get to the point where all you want is a piece of land to farm and to love and to learn and to get into spiritual stuff. And, you know, what we want is really so simple, isn't it?
To be lucky. And it's becoming more and more apparent that that's what we want, because it appears to be becoming more that much more distant from us.
Well, perhaps we only appreciate it because it's at risk.
Well, I think that also... the furthest away you appear to be from something, it's quite possible that the closer you are actually to it, which is a bit of a Freeman Jack kind of idea, really. So I think that's really, I'm really looking forward to listening to the podcast to that myself. I don't know about the people in the chat room or you, but we've got a couple of questions from the chat room, so I'll kind of wrap it up before I play a bit of tunage. And it's Jimmy Hagen again. He's very busy tonight in there. Hiya, Jimmy. Good to see you in there, dude. It says, Doc, as a side note, the internet was built by the industrial military complex, which, of course, we know, but they can't possibly have predicted what we would have done with it. But my, well, they could in theory, but I don't think they did, but that's a whole new question. It says, my question is, how can we be sure we are using it as our tool and not a tool for the military to use against us? And that's as much true of life as it is of the internet, I think. So Stella Berg, your question for 10, how can we be sure we're using life as a tool, as our tool and not a tool for the military to use against us?
My answer to that is creativity and inventiveness and lateral thinking, because, you know, the military industrial complex is all left brain, isn't it?
Doesn't make anything. It destroys things.
Yes. But we are endlessly inventive, and whatever it started off as, we're making wormholes into our own reality with it.
Absolutely great, because I agree entirely. It's always people that have built roads. It's always our creativeness and ingenuity that have enabled us to survive the millennia of just really untold mayhem that's occurred to us. And governing that creativity really doesn't help, I agree entirely. And there's no one can predict what would happen if every single individual on the entire glory ball was to stop paying taxes and start investing that money in their own output. It would wickedly change the way things work, I think, don't you?
I think it's coming. You know, the thing is, people are being starved for money, aren't they?
Yeah.
Especially in England.
There's no money at all.
Yes, and I think one of the things that will start happening as the belts get tighter and tighter is people start reinventing commerce, proper commerce. Yeah. You know, there was an article in New Scientist about 5 years ago that actually caused me to give up my subscription finally. And it was an essay by a Russian economist saying, you know, we need really to look at the black economy, because all of this people living on a dollar a day in the poor countries, we just haven't been looking at their full economic activity, because most of it is on the black economy. It's done things like barter and stuff. And
dark, we've got money.
And tax it. And I thought, you finally noticed that most people do not engage entirely in financial products. They swap things.
On that subject, do you know what kind of massive realization is about to occur, in my opinion, in India? I watched
withdrawal of money.
Yeah, I watched a Corbett report where they removed the 500... what they called their currency or whatever it is, 500 unicorn note, and they removed the 1,000 unicorn note, and then they only made replacement funds available to a limited extent from the physical banks, and said to everybody else, hey, just start using digital currency. So they've never had credit cards, bank accounts, any of the kind of interim stages we've got. And because they can't get the physical notes from the bank without queuing up for days, they're just signing up for the digital coupons. Now, the thing is that really is going to do to a certain extent what the world management team wants. It's going to pull a load of people into a domain where they really haven't been before. But the thing is with India is there's hundreds of millions of people that rely on cash. There's still people breaking rocks by hand to build roads and things like that. So that's going to be the 98% hit. There's going to be a bunch of people who respond to that maneuver in creative ways that are as yet completely unimaginable, I think, to the financial money masters. But it's happening in various degrees of complexity, I think, here, there, everywhere. What we're realizing is that our capital is community, and our currency is people, and all the rest of it is an illusion.
I think there are ideas, there are memes who have a lifespan of their own, and it may be that finally this meme about money is coming to an end. Because one day it will simply seem irrelevant to people. You know, I've got a cow. Why do you want to give me pieces of paper for a cow? You know, I want some wood to build my house with.
And you always go, oh, well, you can't swap a cow for a chair or a cup of tea or whatever. But, I mean, that's one of the things that me and Synchro are concentrating on. We've got bottles of apple juice, hundreds of bottles of apple juice that we made that are kind of like, I don't know, a couple of quid a shot or whatever. We're growing herbs, we're growing chilies, we're growing loads of things that are really well worth less than a fiver. And obviously we need quite a lot of them to buy a cow, but at the same time we can, in the process of growing them all and interacting with our suppliers and all the people that are helping us, we're kind of developing a market, and we'll just have thousands of things that in themselves are, in theory, kind of worthless, because what's a pound, you know? But in their actuality, when applied to kind of like trading locally and getting things done, they should, in theory, work quite well. And I suppose in order to find out, you'll have to watch this space.
And of course, you wouldn't own a cow. What would happen is the village would own a cow.
Yeah. I'd love to share a cow. I really, really enjoyed milking a cow. It was one of the best ways of starting the day with me forehead in the flank of a warm, furry animal. I bloody loved it. But I wouldn't want a cow.
No. You know, we will go back to the commons. We've got one near us. It's called the Blakeney Hill Growers. And they have a little herd of goats, and the goats don't belong to anybody. They both belong to the growers.
Well, they belong to the goats.
Yeah, well, they do really, don't they?
That's really wicked.
We need to give up the whole thing about mine. I mean, we belong to the land. It doesn't belong to us. We belong to our communities. They don't belong to us. I've long had this philosophy in my life. I own five things. And they have changed a little bit over the years, but why would I own any more? You know, five things is my insecurity, if you like. The other things have just come to live with me for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of them have stayed a long while and some of them haven't. But if that's where I put my self into my washing machine or, you know, my practice chair or something like that, what good is that to me? Are there any things?
Your real strength is in you and the way you get on with other people or not, and that's it.
Yes, my wealth, I feel most fortunate in that I'm loved by a lot of people. And I don't know why, I never will know why, and I have no right to ask why. But I feel very blessed, because that is riches to me. If I need things, I ask for them.
Brilliant, because that's my experience too. I feel loved and respected by a load of people who I love and respect, and there's no value you can put on that, and you certainly can't value that kind of social capital in IOUs, promissory tokens. You just can't. And until you try it, folks, you can't know how much more valuable that is than the money. The money isn't relevant. It's really not. It's just a replacement for something that is relevant. And that's what we've been talking about tonight, isn't it, Stella?
Yes, it is. If you go all the way back to childhood, and as I will assume for a moment that all of you had moments of happiness, if not long times of happiness in your childhood, some of the most blissful times were just ordinary, being surrounded by people who loved you. And I think we never really change from that through our whole lives. I think that is what is most precious, to be understood and loved.
And the best way to get that back is to give it out.
Yes.
So, in closing, Stella, Midrin would like to know, of the male and the female, or the man and the woman, which one makes the best chips?
I will always cede that to the male.
Excellent stuff. It's one of my specialities. Roasties, chips and batter. That's what I do best. Radio is just a nonsense, you know. You should come and try my pancakes, guys.
Well, I shall certainly do that.
Excellent. Well, hopefully, Stella, I'm going to be with you actually in Meat Space soon, and I can cook you some pancakes. We'll spend a weekend together and see what we can cook up. In the meantime, considering we were, again, if you approached me like 15, 20 years ago and said, you know, in the not too distant future, you'll be hosting a radio show on feminism, neo-feminism, Satanism, and the family, I'd have probably kicked you to death on the spot and said, down the road with you. But we seem to have done it.
And very well, Ben. As always, I think your interviewing is seamlessly perfect.
Kind of you say so. I haven't yet been unfortunate enough to engage in discussion with an idiot, which it's easy to talk to sensible people, Stella. Whilst much of the world might regard you as a complete lunatic, you're one of the sanest people I know, and it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. I've thoroughly loved this evening, and thank you to Jimmy and all the audience. These are just such fun programs, and I hope you continue to have lots and lots of interesting people on.
Well, there's going to be a bit of a radical review over the next 6 months or so whilst I kind of reconstrue what I'm doing. But it would be really good to have you as a kind of regular correspondent of some sort. We can either record Skype conversations on this and that or have you on the show every now and then. But it really would make it a lot easier for me to have somebody regular to phone up and say, hey, what do you reckon to this? If you'd like to join in, I'd be really happy for you to.
Of course I will. Until I get driven off by the boos of the audience, I will come back and back.
I suspect the audience love you. They've been very quiet this evening, apart from the questions that have come up. But generally, that genuinely means they've actually been paying attention. And I'll tell you what, I've got my kitchen posse through there with Pete Kroll and some new people and all of the regulars. And I have noticed whilst I'm talking to you, even though that I'm wearing headphones, that they've actually been listening. So I'd like to put out a really big wahey to Dr. Rock's Kitchen Posse, to the new people and all the people who've been turning up for so long. And I'd love it if everybody in the chat box says hi to the posse and hi to Stella. Because, you know, I'm just the voice that's here every week. All these other people are the ones that make it go. And feminism, neo-feminism, Satanism, family, it's all a nonsense. There's just us in it, Stella.
Just us and our fertile imaginations.
Brilliant. Thanks very much for that. As you know, I'm not going to be able to talk to you at the moment once I put the music on, so I'll have to say goodbye to you now. And thank you very much, and I'll be in touch very shortly.
Lovely. Thank you yourself. It was a great evening.
Brilliant. We'll do it again soon, eh?
Yes. Take care, then.
Thanks for being you, and thanks for being there, Stella. We all really, really appreciate it.
Lovely. You take care.
Yeah, see you soon, mate.
Dr. Rock's Radio Show on AutonomousMedia.net. Alternative views, alternative tunes, Thursday nights at 9.